Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today, my guest is Dr. Gregory Little. Before I bring him on, a couple of announcements. Coming March 11th, 12th, and 13th this year, Forbidden Knowledge News Con 2022. We're going to have 8 badass presenters. It's going to be online with a Rockfin premium account, and that means you can get the entire conference for only $10. All you have to do is sign up through the Rockfin link in the description, and you're going to get access to not only our conference, but all the premium content and all the content from every creator on Rockfin. And you can always get new episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. And definitely check out the podcasts we feature on the Forbidden Knowledge Network. You get those on our website, forbiddenknowledge.news. We will actually be back available on YouTube, limited as usual, tomorrow. I thought it was 2 weeks, but apparently I was only banned for a week. So good news for those who are still catching us on YouTube. Also follow us on Facebook. Those links are all in the description. And with the state of the supply chain right now, it would be a great time to invest in emergency food supply from My Patriot Supply. They are the experts in emergency preparedness. And right now, if you order their emergency food, which stays good in storage for up to 25 years, you can get up to $100 off a 2-week supply. Just click the link in the description and get your emergency food supply today. Today, I want to welcome Dr. Gregory Little. He is a researcher and author of over 30 books. His research has been featured on the National Geographic Channel, MSNBC, Discovery, and the History Channel. Dr. Little, welcome, and how are you?
I'm doing good. Middle of winter, but things are good, except for COVID. A lot of people stuck inside, but I'm doing great. You doing good?
I'm doing great. I've been looking forward today. It's going to be a great discussion. I'd really love to talk about aspects of our hidden history that most of academia, modern archaeology, and maybe even, you know, most of mainstream science wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. But it appears more and more likely to be true as researchers like yourself put these puzzle pieces together, and we find out more and more that our history is much more interesting and fantastic than much of academia would like to put forward. But this is your first time on. I'd love to hear really what got you interested in these topics and what set you on your path.
Well, I've been asked that before. I usually give the same answer, but the honest answer, I'll give the completely honest answer today, and that is I have no idea. I don't know. I don't know what set me off in this. I think that to really talk in an even deeper layer here, I think there's some genetic stuff that goes on with people's interests in things. Some people are interested. It's like people that are obsessed with sex, which is a lot of people, but there's a genetic component to that. There's a genetic component. The genetic component goes to hormones and drives and all that. But there's a genetic component to lots of things. So, yeah, I think there's a genetic component. My grandfather was a dowser. Now, he was an elected official in a town in Pennsylvania. He was a supervisor at a factory in our town. But he did dowsing. And he did what are called powwows. And a powwow is a healing thing that you do. And he passed. He gave me some of that before he died. There are certain things that you're supposed to say and do when you do this healing stuff. But I think there's a genetic component in it. I can say this. My mother and father had no interest whatsoever in any of this. My brother and sister have no interest whatsoever in any of it. And so I think there's something deeper that goes on. Clearly, there are things that happen in our early life. Like we moved to Huntsville, Alabama after John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And when we moved there, my father went to work at Redstone Arsenal. He actually met, good God, man, the German rocket scientist, his name.
Werner von Braun?
He met Werner von Braun. And I asked him, my dad died a few months ago. He was 96. And I asked him about his meeting with von Braun. And I said, he said, oh, yeah, we ate together. And I said, what did you say? What did you talk about? And he said, I have no idea. I don't remember. And I said, well, how did you meet him? And he said, well, we were at Redstone Arsenal, and we were in line at a sub shop to get a submarine sandwich. And he was behind me, and he said he ordered the exact same thing that I did. We looked at each other, and he said, oh, let's sit down and talk. So that was it. But, I mean, there's that clearly plays a role. Moving to Huntsville, I remember reading about UFOs when we moved to Huntsville. And that was 1964, folks, so that was a long time ago. And of course, I was real young then. At least I think I was real young then. I don't remember real well. But there's events like that. There's things that happen in my own life that are sort of inexplicable that I can't really get a handle on. They just happened. So the interest has always been there as long as I can recall. I will say this. I had no interest in Edgar Cayce. I'm sure at some point here we'll talk about Edgar Cayce. I had no interest in the Cayce readings and all the information contained in that. Zero interest in Atlantis, nothing. And that's the thing. One of the things we're best known for are being Atlantis researchers, which is kind of weird. But part of that Atlantis research stuff, my wife and I spent 25 weeks on boats in the Bahamas searching underwater areas for archaeological remains. But I had no interest in it initially. It just sort of happened. My initial interest was UFOs. I wrote about UFOs. I wrote about Carl Jung. I got really interested in Carl Jung stuff. And of course, my background in psychology fit into all this. And, but I really can't pin down anything and say, this is why I got into anything, except the Native American stuff. The Native American, my interest in Indian mounds, which I'm the mound guy. I wrote a mound encyclopedia. It's very well respected, very authoritative, massive book. And I'm in the process of trying to update it now. But that happened. My interest in that happened through a series of dreams. Absolutely true story. I had these dreams after I finished my first book in 1983 is when I had it written and sent off to publishers. I started having a series of dreams where I was standing on Indian mounds taking pictures. And then I was on another mound taking pictures and another and another. And I had no idea what an Indian mound was then. Like most people, I thought it was a little tiny hump of earth, like a conical hunk of earth. And under it were burials. That's all I knew. And that is true to some extent. There are lots and lots of those, but there are also some really incredible mounds and geometric earthworks, particularly in the United States. But anyway, that came from dreams. And then after my first book came out, talking about Native American stuff, my family gave me a picture and my parents and my aunt and uncle started telling me, oh, yeah, you have Native American blood in you. And so they gave me the pictures and talked about that. And it was something that they had concealed for many years because I suspect the family was ashamed of it at one time. But I kind of embraced it. It's not very much. We don't have very much of it. And chances are loads and loads of Americans have some Native American blood in them. So that's my answer. It's a long answer, I know. I tend to give long, long answers.
Oh, no, that's perfectly fine. We love long answers here. But it gives us, you know, so much to go off of. We got so much we could talk about today. But like I said, I want to start at least with a little bit of our hidden history. Now, the more we learn about the age of humans, the further that seems to go back. The more we learn about how advanced we actually were in our ancient past, that seems to go up. And how our spiritual practices are constantly changing as we learn new things about our ancient ancestors. First, let's start with, you know, possibly Atlantis. How far back do you think advanced humans could have possibly been here?
Well, I think there were depends what you mean by advanced, but there were civilizations on Earth long ago, could be hundreds of thousands of years ago. But it's most likely that, or pretty clear, that before 10,000 BC, maybe 11,000 BC, 12,000 BC, there were some pretty advanced civilizations. And we know that through the discovery of Göbekli Tepe in Turkey and Tarahan Tepe in Turkey, which is very much like Göbekli Tepe, maybe even older. And we know from various other places like Malta and even places in the UK and South America, which is the Americas really have some of the most incredible stuff in it. But it goes back a long time. Those civilizations were destroyed. Plato talked about it in his dialogues where he discussed Atlantis. And Plato really began by saying that there have been many, many prior civilizations that were pretty advanced, and they were destroyed time and time again. And they were destroyed, according to Plato, through some sort of, I'm going to use the word extraterrestrial, but I mean like an asteroid. An asteroid's extraterrestrial. Maybe an asteroid, a comet, but something, which they saw as like Thor throwing down a thunderbolt to destroy people. And that's how he talked about the gods of the sky were upset. And in response, and that's where his dialogues ended. He was talking about Atlantis, and he said they were upset with him, and they decided to do something from the sky, and he never finished it. He died before he got a chance to finish it. So, yes, I think Atlantis actually, Atlantis was a maritime culture that existed all around the Atlantic, including North and parts of North America, South America, Central America, the Caribbean. It also included the Azores in the middle of the ocean, the Canary Islands, Spartel, which was an island right outside of Gibraltar that's now underwater, and certain areas along the coast of Portugal and Spain and France. I think all of that is part of the Atlantis Empire. Of course, everybody wants to try and find the center city of Atlantis, which they have zeroed in on little circular islands, maybe 2 to 3 miles in diameter. But Plato made it very clear. The center city of Atlantis was on a very large island, 250 miles by roughly 400 miles. And that's certainly not a tiny island like Spartel or the island in the Mediterranean called Thera or Santorini. Can't be. And plus, they're in the Mediterranean. And Plato said that Atlantis was located outside of the Mediterranean in the true ocean. And you had to go through what he called the Pillars of Hercules, which is the Straits of Gibraltar, to get to the true ocean. And if you hopped from island to island, you could get to an opposite continent. So it's very clear that in 600 BC, Plato was aware that there were islands in the Atlantic and that if you went from island to island, you would eventually reach a continent on the other side. And of course, that's what Columbus was looking for. But as it was known long before Columbus, we know the Vikings were here and lots of other stuff. So, but I think Atlantis was a maritime culture all over the place.
Now, how advanced do you think they were? You said, you know, maritime, there's some researchers that believe they were extremely advanced up to the point, you know, with ability to traverse the stars or have flight. Yeah. I don't know. What do you think about their capabilities of technology and the possibility that a good bit of it was lost? It seems like, you know, if they were advanced, it would have been a lot different than what we think of as advanced technology today, right?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I will say this. Do you know, you're familiar with who Edgar Casey the psychic
is? Yes, of course.
Okay. He had a son whose name was Edgar Evans Casey. That was his youngest son, Edgar Evans Casey. And Edgar Evans, I remember we did an interview with him. We filmed an interview that we did on a documentary. And Edgar Evans made the point that the more advanced a civilization is, the easier it is to destroy. And here's what he meant by that. We don't build today with blocks of stone, not really. You know, if you look at the Great Pyramid, it's built with blocks of stone. We do use bricks and stone and all that, but we also use mortar. There's no mortar in that. So we don't build like that anymore. And so we're more advanced than they were. We build with steel, which can rust, and steel will be gone. If you don't take care of it, if you don't paint it, if you don't get rid of the rust, if you don't constantly maintain it, it gets destroyed. The same with concrete. Concrete breaks down, gets destroyed. Same with everything we do. If we didn't do anything at all, if humans disappeared, that's a great show to watch, by the way, What If Humans Disappeared? Within 10,000 years, you wouldn't see anything. And even before 10,000 years, you wouldn't see anything. You wouldn't see any cars that are left, even though they'd all be left and rusted and rotted in place. Chances are in 10,000 years, the only thing we would find are bits of plastic, plastic that doesn't deteriorate very fast. It has to be exposed to the sun or chemicals, and then it never really just breaks into smaller and smaller pieces. But a really modern civilization is very easy to destroy. Imagine, for example, if an EMP, electromagnetic pulse, hit the entire world and it shut down the entire electrical grid. Everything shut down. We would not have sewers. We would not have running water. We would not have any anything that's electrical whatsoever. How long would we survive, and who would survive? Only people that are who are prepared for it, or who are really, really smart and really, really capable of doing things, would survive. So Edgar Evans was making the point that even if Atlantis did exist and it was destroyed some 12,000 years ago, which would put it at 10,000 BC, which is what both Casey and Plato said. Plato gave us a date of 9,600 BC. Even if it was destroyed then, chances are the only thing we'd find is stone. Everything else is gone. Now, we did years of looking at looking underwater in the Bahamas, and we found 31 crashed planes. A lot of those planes were down for maybe 20, 25 years, and they were almost gone. There were some of them that were down there a lot longer than that. But I mean, it's like everything is just deteriorating on them. It's just gone. We found ships. We found four or five ships. The wooden ships just totally disappear. And it's from a type of worm, a wood worm that gets in them. And the only way that the wood gets preserved under there in the ocean is if sand covers it, and then the worms can't get to it. So it is very, very easy for an advanced civilization to be destroyed. The ones that aren't are the ones that used stone or lived in caves and did cave paintings and all that. So, yeah, I think there was an advanced civilization. I don't think that they had spaceships. A lot of that comes from people speculating on what Edgar Casey said. So let's talk about what Plato said about it. Plato talked about horses and chariots and spears and bows and arrows. He talked about them having the capability of traveling really well, of getting across the ocean. But of course, they were using sailing vessels and all that. Plato didn't talk about anything they had advanced, except they were very, very good at what they did. Casey, on the other hand, said that they could travel in the air. And from that, that they could communicate with other spheres in the universe. And that there were visitations from other spheres. That's in the Casey readings. So a lot of people have assumed that Casey's saying they had spaceships, they had nuclear power, God knows what they had, airplanes, whatever. But if you really read Edgar Casey's readings, at the height of Atlantis, which he gave a date of 28,000 BC as being when Atlantis reached its technological height. So according to Casey, Atlantis began in 200,000 BC. In 28,000 BC, it reached its height in technology. And the height was this. He said that they used what would almost be like a dirigible or a blimp to travel in the air. They generated the hot air. They were like hot air balloons, but they generated that by using crystals. And that they would focus the light from the sun into the crystals and then through some mechanical means create hot air. And that is what also gave these devices their propulsion. So, all right. So that was the height. But what were those made out of? Here we go. You might think, oh, they had rubber or plastic or whatever. They didn't. Casey said they used the skin of pachyderms to create the exterior of these blimp-like objects that they used to fly. Pachyderm is an elephant, or it could be a woolly mammoth or any of that, since that's also in the same family. So that doesn't sound real advanced. It sounds real smart to me. You're using what you have in the natural world, but it doesn't sound all that advanced. Casey said that they also they had the ability to travel quickly across the water, not because they had nuclear power or that they had submarines or any of that kind of stuff, but they did have some sort of steam engine capability. Don't know exactly any details in that because there weren't any details in the readings on that. But they reached the ability to grow a lot of food. Their agriculture was pretty good, but they had horses. They used chariots. They had wagons and all that. They didn't have automobiles. None of that is in the Casey readings. But he said there were two distinct groups that occurred at this time. One was called the Children of the Law of One that were very, very spiritual people. The other is called the Sons of Belial or Sons of Belial, depending on how you want to pronounce it. And they were into power and control, and they're the ones who decided to invade the Mediterranean, which was the beginning of the end for Atlantis when they decided to kind of rule the known world. So Casey's that's sort of Casey's thing. There were these two sides. The Sons of the Law of One, before Atlantis was destroyed, they're the ones that made the three Hall of Records, one of which is in Egypt. I'm sure we'll get to that. And we'll explain how that even occurred, because that's pretty bizarre. That sounds almost like UFOs when you get into the details. But anyway, the Sons of the Law of One were very spiritual, and most of them, before Atlantis was destroyed, migrated to the Americas. And a lot of them went to extreme North America at the end of the last ice age, and they merged into the Native Americans that were already there, and the Atlanteans became the Iroquois. And some of them went to South America, particularly in the Andes, and they merged with the people who were already there, but they were not the Children of the Law of One. That was the Sons of Belial. And they were into power and control over others, as well as sacrifices, human sacrifices. So
now,
go ahead.
According to Casey, how was Atlantis destroyed?
Casey says it was destroyed in one day and night, but there were people who were observing it on the main island. They were on highlands in the main island. And according to Casey, a lot of people escaped it. And it occurred from something from the sky. But that's it. We don't know. And that's the same thing that Plato said. It was destroyed from something coming from the sky. But it was something coming from the sky that had water levels rise almost instantly and literally wipe out a civilization. And in both of those, it sounds almost like a tsunami caused by a comet or, something crashing onto Earth.
Right. And
that's what they both say.
That's fascinating. And you mentioned the Halls of Records that Casey talked about as well. And I'd love to hear about this, because this is really fascinating.
Well, to me, that's one of the more interesting parts of the story. And that's what people are really looking for, the Halls of Records. Mm. So before Atlantis was destroyed, the Sons of the Law of One, and that word sons is male, I know, but there were priests and priestesses in Atlantis, and they were highly spiritual, and they communicated with the other realm, whatever you want to call it. They called it higher spheres and the outer realms. They communicated with them through a crystal technology, crystals. And they had a name for the crystal. It was called the Tui Stone, T-U-A-U-I, Tui Stone. Later became a fire stone, and it became a weapon because it was weaponized by the Sons of Belial. And that's actually one of the things that caused the 28,000 BC destruction of Atlantis, because there were three destructions. But we're talking about the last one here. So before 10,000 BC, roughly 10,500 BC, the priests and priestesses were communicating with these outer realms through this crystal technology. And in the course of these communications, they were told that Atlantis was about to be destroyed. and it was going to be destroyed by something coming in from outer space, and that they needed to create three places in the world where the records of Atlantis, their history, their culture, their technology, their beliefs, their ideas, all that, the records of Atlantis could be preserved for all time, for later generations to get. It was important to preserve it. So they were tasked with creating these three places. They were told what to put in it, and it took them a while to get it together. So they sent out three different groups to create these record halls. One of them went to Egypt, and the group that went to Egypt built a chamber under what is now the right paw of the Sphinx. It's like 30 or 40 feet down. It is a stone chamber. That's the one everybody's looked at. Believe it or not, in the early 1950s, two women who were members of the Association for Research and Enlightenment, which is the ARE or the Edgar Cayce's membership organization, these two ladies were granted permission by the Egyptians to go to the Sphinx and use drills right next to the right paw of the Sphinx and drill down to try and find it. That was in the 1950s. Two women with no backgrounds, no, they weren't archaeologists, no college degrees, any of that. They just simply had money. So they were allowed to do this. So there's been a lot more research there. And yes, there is a chamber, a chasm, a cave, something down there. Zahi Hawass and the Egyptian government says it's a large crack or maybe a bit of a cave or a cavern or something down there. There's something there, never been looked at. And that's as far as we know about that. So that was one. The second Hall of Records was, and this is one of Cayce's most famous readings. He gave a reading in 1934 where he said that a portion of Atlantis would rise again in 1968 or 1969, and that a temple of the Poseidians, which was the Hall of Records, could be found by making a survey to the south of Bimini, a geological survey to the south of Bimini in the Bahamas, going along the Gulf Stream. And he said that it was now underwater beneath the slime of ages. I made a film while we were there. There's a bunch of documentaries, and one of them I got out of a boat, this little boat we had, where we had gone up and down Andros, to tell you how difficult it is doing some of this research. I'm next to this boat that's about the size of a rowboat. It was actually a sponge diver's boat and had a small motor on it, but it had next to no draft. So I'm standing there, and you can see it looks like the water is coming up to my waist, basically right to my waist, and I'm holding on to the side of the boat. And what I say is I'm standing in what appears to be deeper water, but it's only 6 inches deep. And I've just simply sunk into this. And so I had to pull myself up. You can see all this white muck coming up. And I said, if this is not the slime of ages, I don't know what it is. And it really is. It's a pure white, looks like mud, but it's like paste. And it's deep. I don't know how deep it goes down. We've taken poles and pushed down 8-9 feet before. Very difficult to get out of, but that's the way a lot of the Bahamas are. And that's, if that ain't the slime of ages, I don't know what is. Interestingly, that temple in near Bimini is the one everybody's looked at. And of course, what is known as the Bimini Road was found in 1968, reported in 68 by a geologist and a botanist by the name of J. Manson Valentine, made national news. We had no desire whatsoever to look at what is called the Bimini Road, a J-shaped formation of large blocks of stone that looks very unusual just off the coast of Bimini. But I will say in 2012, my wife and I did discover what really looks like a collapsed temple about 30 miles south of Bimini along the Gulf Stream in a very unusual area. It's made out of polished green schist. Schist is S-C-H-I-S-T. It's a type of stone that is kind of unusual. The Oracle of Delphi in Greece is made out of green schist. And the reason I say that is because we had the schist tested by three of the top geological university laboratories in the United States. And they say that it's green schist that either came from Greece or Norway in the Bahamas. And it looks like this collapsed building. It's a huge tear-shaped structure that looks like a tsunami hit it. There are giant flat pieces of polished stone that look like flooring. There are walls and beams of stone. There are fluted columns that are down there. And it's this big teardrop shape that is almost 500 feet long. It's a couple hundred feet wide, and it looks just like a tsunami hit it on this high spot. It's 30 feet underwater right now. But in 10,000 BC, it was about 110 feet above the waterline in 10,000 BC. So it would have been a stunning thing. It would have really been stunning to see it there. So anyway, that was the last thing that we found. The third Hall of Records. Let me finish that. We're not allowed to go back to it and do any archaeological work. It is now an officially, we notified the Bahamas. It's an official archaeological site. And how strange is this? A salvage claim has been made on this structure with the possible intention of removing and reconstructing it somewhere, trying to reconstruct it on land. Microsoft Corporation. After we discovered it and after we publicized it, the Bahamas knew. I didn't know this at the time, but Microsoft sponsors a lot of archaeological work around the country. They have a foundation around the world. They have a foundation that does that. And so the head of it,
surprising.
They contacted me and asked me if I'd take them there. And I said, we just got notice from the Bahamas government. We're not allowed to take anybody or tell them where it is. The only thing we could do, the only thing we can legally do is go back to this and film it if under a film permit, because everything you do in the Bahamas has to be done under a permit. So a film permit, you can film, but you can't touch. An archaeological permit now is almost impossible. It's very, very expensive to get. And you have to designate the area and you can't just look around. You have to already know what you're going to look at to get the archaeological permit. So that effectively just shut it all down. But anyway, the only thing I could do is give him the names of our contacts in the Bahamas, who we would charter a liveaboard boat. We took our own boat over to do our research, but we took a liveaboard charter along. We just pull ours along the back and then we'd use ours, which was very fast, had a low, was very safe and very fast. And we could go a long, long way on it. Had only a 1 foot draft. On this catamaran that we took. But anyway, okay, so the third Hall of Records, we've also been to this area. Casey said it was in the Yucatan, meaning the Yucatan Peninsula, before he even used that term Yucatan. The state of Yucatan did not exist. Mexico hadn't broken them into states, and Yucatan was that whole area. It was the entire peninsula. And he said that at that exact time, I think this was 1934, that he gave the reading on the third, on the three Hall of Records. And he said that it was at a site in the Yucatan where the University of Pennsylvania was at that very moment excavating and sending artifacts to the University of Pennsylvania Museum in Philadelphia, Penn. And so my wife and I got very interested in that. She took the lead on that, and she wound up going to, we went to the University of Pennsylvania, but she got permission to go into the archives, get the actual field notes from 1934, get in this area where they could lay out all the artifacts that they found at the University of Pennsylvania, that the University of Pennsylvania found at this site. The site was identified back in 1935 by the ARE as Piedras Negras, Guatemala. Piedras Negras means black rocks, and it is right along the Asumacinta River in Guatemala. It is in not the middle of Yucatan. It's toward the western side of the Yucatan, But the Usumacinta River divides Mexico and Guatemala. It's the dividing line between the two, and it's used by drug runners. So my wife wrote this book with an ARE, one of the directors, John Van Auken. It did very, very well. And we decided then at the time, it was like impossible to arrange anything to get in. But we did arrange a thing. And if you look back at like the what those 1800s guys did, the antiquarians who would, you know, two of them would spend a whole bunch of money and get a group of people to go in and do a safari, go somewhere, and they get 20 helpers. And that's what we did. We did that to get into Guatemala and to go to Piedras Negras, except we had to go in these boats. And these boats, I'm calling them boats, they were one person wide and extremely long because we had to go on the Usumacinta River, which rises and falls every day, is very dangerous, has white water and falls. Unbelievable trip that we took. And we went to this spot, very remote, nothing there, nobody, no tourists there. We saw drug runners at night on it going by us on the river. After we got back 2 weeks later, after we did this, and we did talk to the chief archaeologist in Guatemala who had done work at Piedras Negras. He agreed with us where we identified what Edgar Cayce probably said was the entrance area to what he said was the Third Hall of Records. And it's in a tunnel in a mountain, basically, under a temple. So there's a temple on a mountain, and down on the side, Cayce said on the shadow side, there's an entrance into a tunnel, and that's where it is. And we found that area, and I remember asking the archaeologist point blank on the map, this area. And he said, I would love to go there and dig in there. And he said, yes. He said, we're certain there's a tunnel there too. How'd you deduce that? And we said, well, we stuck our hand in this thing and felt air coming out. A long involved story, but it was an opening. And we said, the air just doesn't come out of an opening. This opening goes somewhere. And so the only thing they needed was permission and a whole lot of money, which we didn't want to invest in it because they wouldn't allow us to be there when they did the work. It's basically going to be a government thing. So anyway, those are the three Hall of Records. They all have identical things in them. The history. And Cayce talked about a lot about what was specifically in those. So they would survive for all time.
That is so interesting. Now, I want to hear about what he said was in there. But as far as the Hall of Records that could possibly be under the Sphinx, isn't there, yeah, you know, definitely a large cavernous chamber that is under the Sphinx, right? That they don't talk about.
Well, the Egyptian, like Zahi Hawass, who's no longer the head of Egyptian archaeology, but the people that are the head of it, they pretty much are in line with this. They believe that, or they say that what is under it down there is a crack where the rock is separated, or it's part of a tunnel, or it's a cave system. It's part of a cave. We know there are caves under there. My co-author and very close friend, Andrew Collins, discovered a cave system under the Giza Plateau, actually told Zahi about it. Within 30 minutes after he discovered it, he was sending me emails about it because we had gotten him funded through the ARE to do this, to do that research there. And so there is a cave system there. Zahi knows about it now. He didn't know about it at the time. But they claim that it's just a cave system. To my knowledge, no one has actually dropped a camera down in there. No one has actually been able to look. Andrew has discovered that there's a cemetery that is closed off to foreigners. It's a very clearly, it's a closed cemetery, Islamic and Muslim cemetery. It's right by the three great pyramids, and it's next to this hill called Gebel Jibli, which is a high hill. You can overlook all three of the pyramids from it. But right beneath it is where this complex is. And in it, in this complex, there is a gated fenced well, and it's a round well. At the bottom of the well, they know there is a tunnel, and the tunnel heads straight to the Sphinx, which is only a few hundred yards away. There is no history. Nobody knows if anybody has ever been down there and tried to take that tunnel and look, but it's not the kind of thing that anybody but an Islamic archaeologist could do. Andrew and I have talked about it for years, and we've talked about trying to get somebody to use remote technology, get an underwater drone with a camera that can follow this thing. But to our knowledge, it hasn't been done yet, and we got to find somebody who's willing to do it.
Wow, man, that would be amazing if that could ever happen.
Yeah.
Now, talk a little bit about what Casey says were in these halls of records.
Well, some of it's real specific. 32 stone tablets. That's pretty specific. And the reason they wrote on stone is obvious. It's not going to degrade like paper. You know, we put things on, I got them all over the place, can't even find one. We put things on CDs, not so much anymore, DVDs, not so much anymore. We put them on thumb drives. We have external hard drives. You know, I got my external hard drives. The problem with all this, every one of these is going to degrade. And I don't know if you've got VHS tapes.
I used to.
Yeah, and you try to put them in. They seem to degrade over time. After VHS tapes get 30 to 40 years old, they don't seem to work as well. They jam up and all that. And the same thing, I find that my DVDs don't work as well. They seem to skip more and they're degrading every little scratch, everything. And books, I have a lot of books from the 1800s, very expensive books. I have some from the 1600s. And while they're still usable, they're only a few hundred years old. It's not like they're 10,000 years old. And those books are all going to be a pile of dust that is scattered all over by the time 10,000 years are gone. None of those books will remain. They're all going to be gone. They can't last. So stone tablets. He says that all 32 tablets are covered with a type of hieroglyphic that is pre-Egyptian, that it'll take several people a long time to actually decipher. But he said it. They're written, you know, you got a block of stone, and it actually has eight sides. Was that right? No, six sides. What's wrong with me? So you have the four edges, and then you have the two sides. And so they're all covered with hieroglyphics. All six sides are covered. So you have those stone tablets. He said there are weapons. Spears are an example, but they have examples of all their weapons. Clothing. They have examples of all their clothing. They have examples of other technology, such as the technology involved in the Firestone. The Firestone became a weapon, a beamed weapon that sounds, in the readings, it sounds exactly like a laser or a maser, M-A-S-E-R. A maser was the predecessor of a laser, but it sounds exactly like that technology. But he says he said that it's there. It's contained in the three Hall of Records. So that's what it is. It's like their whole culture, everything that was in their culture is contained in those three record halls.
Wow, that is fascinating. Now, what about when it comes to any other profound, I guess, channelings or downloads that Casey got? What are some that really stick out for you besides Atlantis?
Well, you know, I really can't prove a great deal of the Atlantis stuff. I'll talk about some of the historical stuff. Casey said people were in the Americas a long, long time ago. He said that there are specific readings that say that people came into the Americas in 50,000 BC. Lots of them did. And of course, that he said that in the 1930s, that 50,000 BC, large groups of people came in. And he said they came in from the South Pacific, and a lot of them went to South America. It's only been in the past 5 years that it's been confirmed that large groups of people came in to South America from the South Pacific in 50,000 BC. Now, how Casey came up with that and how he knew that is absolutely beyond me, because when Casey did these readings, they hadn't even accepted that people were here in 9,000 BC, much less 50,000 BC. Until Clovis was discovered, it was believed that people were only in the Americas for maybe 4,000 to 6,000 years, that they were all relative newcomers. So Casey's readings were insane at the time that he gave them. So that is one, the 50,000 BC. Casey also said that people entered the Americas in 28,000 BC, coming from, again, the South Pacific. Some came from the East. And he said that some actually came into Alaska and down in 28,000 BC. And then Casey said huge groups came over in 10,000 BC. The Atlanteans came up and to North America. They went into Central America and South America. But he said in 10,000 BC, floodgates opened up and a whole bunch of people came over from Russia, Siberian Russia, which is exactly what the whole Clovis theory was. But he said that even before the Clovis theory took over. So, and that's the date that the Clovis people say. They say hordes of nomads came over around 10,000, 11,000 BC. That's Clovis. So Casey said that. Casey very clearly, there are two readings where he very clearly said that the stock market was going to crash in 1929. I'm not making that up. I'm not reading anything into it. There are two very clear readings that Casey gave saying the stock market in 1929 is going to crash, because up to then people were making bukus of money. Just throw money into the stock market and it doubled in a couple months, and it kept doubling and doubling. And he told two investors, get out now. So that is a good example. That, I mean, that's pretty impressive. Probably the weirdest thing. This I love this story. And it's a true story. It's in the Casey readings. The weirdest one I know of is the story of oil of smoke. I've been trying to find a bottle of oil of smoke for years. Oil of smoke sounds bizarre. Anyway, a person wrote to Casey getting for health reading, which Casey's best known for giving health readings. Casey gave roughly 20 some thousand psychic readings, almost 15,000 of them. Every word was written down. So out of all of his readings, 2/3 of them were for health. Somebody had an ailment. They wrote Casey and said, I've got an issue. Can you help me with it? Casey would go into his trance. He'd do a psychic diagnosis on the person, and then he'd recommend a remedy. That allowed researchers, physicians, to find out from the patient, was the diagnosis correct and what happened when you took the remedy? And so they came up with the final idea that Casey's health readings were 84 to 88% accurate. That's been published in medical journals, several articles. Medical journals, the Journal of the American Medical Association, called Casey the father of holistic medicine. And so all of that is very cool. But in one of his health readings, he recommended that the person take oil of smoke. They actually telegraphed that back to the person. Well, the person's physician had sent off for the reading. So the physician sent a telegraph back to the Casey organization, or it wasn't an organization, then it was his doctor, and said, what the heck is oil of smoke? I've never heard of it. And so they did another reading. And Casey said, contact this pharmacist in Kentucky and tell him to look on his shelves, that oil of smoke is on his shelf. So they sent that telegraph back. A day later, a telegraph came back and said, the pharmacist says there is no oil of smoke here. He's never heard of it. So they said, they did another reading with Casey. Casey said, tell him, this is very specific. Get on a step reach up, move stuff out of the way, reach to the very back. There you'll find it. They did, and sent that telegram off. Telegram came back. Okay, this pharmacist only recently bought the pharmacy. He only recently bought it. He bought it lock, stock, and barrel, which is the way you did it then. And he did what you said, and there it was. Oil of smoke was back there. And they used it. The remedy worked for the person. How did Casey know it was there? All documented. Every bit of that is accurate. Of course, skeptics say, I don't believe it. You know, it's all made up, and all, but it's not made up. And there are lots of very bizarre stories like that. I'll give you another one that's weird. Casey had this ability. The real proponents of Casey will tell you he could sleep on a book and he'd memorize it. Eidetic memory, but it's beyond eidetic memory. Eidetic memory is looking at something, you know, looking at it and then having a photographic memory of it. So I can shut my eyes and I can see everything on it. Sleeping on something and absorbing it through sleep is absolutely unheard of. There's nothing in the scientific literature or psychological literature on anything like this. I've always been skeptical of that. But in reading all this and then reading a relatively new account and then looking it up about Casey, that a really great researcher, New York Times bestselling author named Sidney Kirkpatrick, who you ought to get on. Sidney is amazing. Sidney pulled these articles and pulled all this out of the Casey files. Back when Casey was 12 years old, Grover Cleveland was president of the United States. He'd just been elected. And Casey lived in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. And his father was very proud of Casey's ability to pretty much look at any book or sleep on it or read or hear anything and memorize it word for word instantly. And he was bragging to the congressman who represented that area of Kentucky. And when he was bragging to this congressman, he told him his son could pretty much memorize anything without even reading it himself, just hearing it, seeing it, whatever. And the congressman had just been appointed ambassador to Peru. And that's why he came to Hopkinsville to see his friends. And so they made a bet. They made a $10 bet, which was then a lot of money. And this speech, the speech the congressman had given to Congress was 150 pages long. And he had it with him, handwritten speech, 150 pages long. And so he bet Edgar's dad that Edgar could not listen to this speech and then give it a day later, word for word, without missing a single word. So what they did was this. Edgar's father read the speech to Edgar before he went to bed that night. The congressman was there. He read all 150 pages to him. Congressman took the speech back. The next morning, the congressman, Edgar's dad, all 50 students in the school, he was in a small school, all the teachers and reporters, including reporters from the Kentucky New Era, were all there. Of course, the congressman was a big deal because he's no longer a congressman. He's now the ambassador to Peru, making his final rounds. And Edgar stood up on a podium and gave the speech word for word, did not miss one word. Now, that's incredible. Now, I've often thought that what Edgar had was an eidetic memory. Eidetic memory is also known as photographic memory. And a lot of people think that it's common. It's incredibly rare. Most of us can look at something and visualize it, but not like that. Not where you'll leaf through page after page of a page and just glance at it. And then you can call up each page in your mind and you can look down and you can see each word. Because Edgar was at the point with this where he would tell his father, and it started with a spelling book. He would tell his father, open up the page, whatever. And he'd say, here's the words, write down that line. Spell them perfectly, line for line. Put it to any page randomly. His dad would say, page 96. And he'd say, what's the third word down? And Edgar would tell him without even looking at it. He'd know what it is. So he had the ability, I believe, what he did before he went to sleep is he leafed through a book pretty quickly and then absorbed it. If you know anything about memory consolidation and the psychology research in that, the best way to study, the best way to do any kind of memorization is to do it before you go to bed. Do it before you go to sleep or take a nap after it. Really concentrate and take a nap or go to bed. That's the way to really learn things. But anyway, that's a fantastic story. Absolutely true. Skeptics don't like any of that. And of course, they discount a lot that Casey said. And Casey was wrong about some things. Not a lot, but he was clearly wrong about some things.
Now, Casey also made some predictions that may not have come to fruition yet.
One of them is that China is going to become a Christian country. He predicted that China would become really the main Christian country in the world at some point. And he was asked, when will that happen? He said, oh, that's way off in the future. And when he would sometimes predict things that are 50, 60 years away. But for in that particular thing, he said, oh, that's just way, way off. He did say that there were earth changes coming. A lot of people have said that was a failed prediction because he said it was going to be in 1998, 97 when it started and happened, that a portion of Japan would fall into the sea and that all these things in California and all that. And what he said is that the future, he was asked a lot of things about the future. And here's what he said, that the future really can't be predicted. That what you can do is, based on the current situation, you can predict what will happen if nothing changes. If the situation doesn't change, you can predict what's going to happen. But he said things are going to change. And he said, so you've got to really understand the future is not set. But here's what will happen if things don't change. Some of the things that he said about, like, Japan, some people have thought that the Yukushima eruption and the tsunami that hit Japan is related to the Casey reading on a portion of Japan. I don't know about that. California has had issues. I don't know about that. That's probably a reading that hasn't come to pass yet, but he said it would take a long time for all that to come to pass. He also said that the Gulf of Mexico, I live in Memphis, Tennessee, and we're on the Mississippi River. And basically, according to Casey, we're going to be Gulf of Mexico frontage property. The Gulf of Mexico is going to go all the way up there. But if you look at the maps that the climate scientists have put out, and if you look at what will happen if all of the ice melts, if all the ice melts, you will see a map showing the Gulf of Mexico goes all the way up, almost all the way to the Great Lakes. And as it goes up, it forms a V. As it goes further up, it gets closer and closer in because, of course, the land is higher and higher there. But we're looking at ocean rises, 250, 300 feet or so, if all of it melted. I don't think all of it's going to melt. But that would be a long time from now, too. Not in our lifetime, not in the lifetime of your children or your grandchildren or their grandchildren. It'll be a long time before that happens. So those are a few examples.
That's really fascinating. Now, for the last few minutes we have, I want to get back to some aspects of our hidden history that you've talked about in some of your books before. But about the possibility that we as a human species could have been a lot more varied and different in the ancient past. They have evidence of giants. They have evidence of individuals with elongated skulls, little people, a whole spectrum of different types of what appears to be humanoid creatures, right?
Yeah. Okay, we'll stick to Casey for a minute. Casey did say there were giants. Casey said there were little people. I can't recall what he called them. He didn't use the word hobbits. It didn't exist then. But I can't recall what he called them. He didn't call them midgets. But anyway, there were small people, and dwarfs maybe is the term that he used. He also talked about, in the time of Atlantis, You know, we didn't, the history that Casey gave of Atlantis is very, very complicated. Lots of details. You know, I broke it into the children of Law of One on one side and the sons of Belial or Belial on the other. Well, the sons of Belial or Belial were into power and control. So one of the things they did was create genetic hybrids of what they called things and automatons. They created worker bees, like humans, part animal, part human, that were designed to serve humans in very specific roles. And again, he called them things, soulless entities that were alive, but were things. He did mention evolution. His statement about when we emerged, Casey's statement about when we, thoroughly modern humans, Homo sapiens sapiens developed, he said it was around 200,000 BC. I think 204,000 BC is the exact date that he gave. And that it was in the mainland of Atlantis. And it was kind of sudden. And there was a man and a woman who developed, which he had. Aemilius was the name of the guy who later became known as Eve in Christian tradition. And Lilith was the female. And that is where we started from. The other humans, the other branches of humanity were around then. And we apparently, our offspring, interbred with them some. So the giants came from, according to Casey, it's almost biblical. The giants came from angels interbreeding with unevolved prehumans, protohumans, an unevolved race. And I don't know about that. I don't remember him saying anything about the little people, where they evolved from, but I would assume the same thing, that they were an evolution from that. Now, in terms of reality, archaeological reality, we know for certain there were really small people. There were hobbits. Hobbit-like beings. The thing about giants, the only thing we know for sure, there were a lot of people in the ancient world who were between 7 and 8 feet tall, and those people were revered. Those people became the elite of the society. In fact, an archaeologist who's a skeptic, who's a well-known skeptic and debunker, who's also a friend of mine named Andrew White, PhD archaeologist, he has labeled that the Edina elite hypothesis, because the Edina culture, which was a culture of mound builders in America or United States, roughly from maybe 3000 BC to about the year 1000 or so, they built giant mounds, and they put huge tombs in the base of the mounds. The tombs were stone and wooden, looked just like British burial mounds, actually, from that time, their barrows. And their stone tombs, stone chambers. That's what's in American mounds. Big stone chambers look just like those in England. But you find these 7 to 8 footers in there, and they're the Edina culture. So what Andrew White has said is that the Edina, for whatever reason, revered these tall people, and they became the elite because, for whatever reason, you know, they're stronger. They are probably better warriors. We know when the first Europeans got into extreme South America, Patagonia, trying to go around the Straits of Magellan at the very bottom of South America. They spent months in Patagonia down there, and they discovered lots and lots of what they called giants. And they said they were up to 10 feet tall. They were called the Ona and the Taluchi. And they made efforts to exterminate him. And one of the people who witnessed the extermination of the Ona and the Taluchi, who wrote about it, and by the time he got there in the middle 1800s, he only saw them killing off the remaining 7 to 8 footers. And that was the man who really invented evolution, Charles Darwin. Darwin wrote about it. He saw these 7 footers. So where they came from, mainstream archaeology tells us there were no giants in the ancient world. they say that there were no more 7 to 8 footers than there are now. And right now, about one of every 150,000 beings is truly 7 feet tall, one of every 150,000. Well, far too many of these have been found in the Adena culture for one out of every 150,000. They all come from the same time frame, and there are dozens and dozens of these that they found and recovered in these Adena era mounds. And so we know that something else was going on then, clearly. There's also a new book by two researchers into the giants, Jim Vieira, who's a very great guy. Jim's a good friend, and Hugh Newman's also a good friend. Hugh's in England, and it's on giants from Europe. And they have found loads and loads of these giant reports from Europe, which American archaeologists really have no expertise in and haven't talked about. But apparently there were a lot of 7, 8, 9, 10-foot people. I want to say this before we get off the topic. I can't tell you a single example of a genuine 10-foot tall skeleton found in the Americas. There are lots of them that are 7 to 8 feet tall, but I can't find any of verified accounts. There's lots of newspaper accounts, but a newspaper account's not a verified account.
It seems pretty sad that modern archaeology and even academia and science they don't seem like they're going to, even anytime soon, start giving this any serious consideration, of the topics that we discussed, you know?
No, they're not going to. I'm sympathetic to their cause. If archaeology paid anything, I might be an archaeologist. The biggest problem with archaeology now is there's no funding for them to do anything. So they're stuck in just talking about a theory and an ideology. They teach, and the only archaeology work that's really going on in the United States is public archaeology, which would be when a road is being built, they have to do a survey to make sure they're not destroying anything of archaeological significance. When you build a building, a public building or something, you'll come in. If you find artifacts out there like skeletal remains and you notify the police, they'll probably bring an archaeologist in and they'll start digging a bit. There's just no funding. They can't dig into mounds now. They just can't do that either because of laws passed in 1889 and 90. The NAGPRA Act, NAGPRA, Native American Grave Protection and Repatriation Act. They can't dig into any burials. So things have changed. So I'm sympathetic to them, but they can't really do much but just theorize about things. So that's the problem. There are no big paying jobs. States have to pay for public archaeologists because they have to maintain cemeteries. I know a guy that's a skeptic who loves to talk about all this, but he doesn't do any work in this field whatsoever. He maintains cemeteries for the U.S. Forestry Service, yet he writes about this and says, oh, there were no giants in here. We archaeologists know all this, but that's all nonsense. He maintains cemeteries in areas that the Tennessee Valley Authority has flooded. So they have cemeteries there. Good guy. He's a good guy, and that's his job in archaeology. But that doesn't make him an expert in giants in America, yet he'll talk about it. And I don't pretend to be an expert either, except I've read more archaeological books on it than he has and done more research on it than he has and published more about it than he has.
Right. Yeah, you know, I have hopes, but you know, I don't think that we will see anything like that.
No,
but, I'm glad that you know independent researchers like yourself are coming out with this information and give us opportunities to take a look at this stuff. And it was fantastic conversation today, and you're coming out with another very interesting looking book in March that I'd love to have you back on to discuss.
Yeah, Origins of the Gods. Yeah. Eric von Däniken wrote the introduction to it, which is unusual because the book, while it admits that ancient aliens may have come here, it does not say that ancient aliens really did much, maybe than just monitor us. It's pretty clear. And we actually totally supported Carl Sagan that. Carl Sagan was a supporter of ancient aliens, believe it or not. And the proof is in there. Carl Sagan believed they came here 10,000 times. Let me say that again. 10,000 times. How do we know that? He wrote it in a journal article, a professional peer-reviewed journal article in 1963. So anyway, yeah, we wrote this book. It is a very, very unusual book. Casey's mentioned in it. There's maybe just two pages of Casey. I don't think giants are mentioned in it one time. There is a lot of archaeology. And in that, basically, we are revealing what Native Americans' deepest spiritual beliefs are, where they came from, what Native Americans really mean when they say that our ancestors came from the stars. That is in there. The fundamental idea of where we came from and what life is all about is in there from the ancient Native American perspective. And what the paranormal is all about. And truthfully, the book's really about UFOs. It's explaining what UFOs, paranormal events are, abductions, interactions with what appear to be aliens, glowing beings, light beings, the contactees, all that is in there, and it's got our explanation. Vandanikin has changed his mind a bit. I want to say that. And you'll see that in his introduction. His introduction is not online. I think the only thing that's online is one of my chapters called What Came from the Stars, and it's about what Native Americans said. Yeah, that book is going to change things. It is decidedly different and new. A lot of Carl Jung is in it, and it's kind of me and Andrew going back to our roots. My first book in 1984 was about UFOs, and Andrew's first book, which came out also in 1984, was about UFOs. So we're going back to our roots.
I love it, man. Looking so forward to that. Like I said, we'll have to have you back on after that book comes out. And thank you so much. This was a fantastic conversation.
Thank you. Been a pleasure. We'll do it again. Just stay in touch.
Definitely so. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening. We'll be talking again tomorrow. See you then.